Tell, and maybe you don't have an experience with this, but have you ever gotten into a debate about faith and science with someone, you know, a non-believer, and just how that went with you? So just share that with someone around. Just say, hey, I got an argument with someone, my coworker or whatever, and just tell them how that went. All right. That go well for anyone? Anyone have any cool? Biology teacher? All right, that happens a lot. We have some, how many biology teachers do we have here? I know we got to have some. All right, there we go. Biology teachers. Three. I counted three. Four. Four. All right. Yeah, that's one of the. That's usually the first point that our kids encounter a debate with faith and science is in their biology class, usually seventh or eighth grade or something like that. So that's usually kind of the first time that we someone's telling you some of the authority is saying something contrary to what you've always believed. All right. Any other interesting? Anyone like argued someone into belief or argued someone into heaven? No. Usually doesn't happen very well that way. So, all right. Now we're gonna talk. I'm gonna take three just kind of scientific topics. And the reason I want to do this: how many of you guys have ever gotten a discussion with an atheist and they just bring up just like the craziest examples of Christianity? Oh man, they're like, well, what about Benny Hinn? And what about, you know, just like crazy stuff? And you're like, dude, that's just a bad example. That's not what we're all like. That's not what we all believe. And what I want to do is just lay out three scientific topics, because when we talk to people about science, we want to make sure that we're using good examples, that we're not using, you know, the straw man, you know, little things that just are undefensible. We want to make sure that we're correct in what we're saying about science when we talk to people. So we're going to hit three different areas. And the first one we're going to talk about dating methods. How many of you guys have ever watch the news or come across something where they found a fossil and they say, hey, this fossil is 35 million years old. All right, we always hear that. But they very rarely say what dating method they used. Sometimes they'll say it, but usually they don't. So I want to show you what dating methods are, how they come up with that, the science behind it, as well as what are the ones that we should be on the lookout for when they're using them out of context. So we're going to do a little science tutorial here real quick. You guys ready for all right, here's the first one. Here, we got the atom. Got a helium atom. So just a little bit of context on the size of an atom. Got an apple here, which is going to be my snack during the next break. How many the atoms that make up this apple? So this made up of a bunch of atoms inside there, very, very, very small. If I were to take this apple and blow it up to the size of the Earth, each atom inside here would blow up to the size of this apple. So if you were to take the whole Earth and fill it with apples, that's how many atoms are inside this apple. Does that make sense? This is going to make total sense because that's just mind-blowing, but that's a whole. Atoms are very, very, very small is the point that I'm trying to get across. They're very, very, very small. The number of atoms in this apple is the number of apples if you made up the whole Earth out of apples. So here we have a very basic atom. It's a helium atom made up of electrons. It's atomic number 2, so it's got 2 electrons and 2 protons. It also has 2 neutrons with it. So this is just a very stable helium atom. And all of the properties of everything around us comes from the number of electrons, protons, and neutrons inside this very basic building block. You just keep on adding more and more, and it gets more and more complex. From helium, which is atomic number one electron, one proton, neutron, up to the very heavy elements that have hundreds, 104, I think, is the highest one. We had them up to 106, but then they found out the guys that did the experiments were lying. It's a perfect example of how if you get as much credit for disproving someone as you do for proving it. So the guys that disproved them, they were some South Korean guys. They're not on the good list of scientists anymore, so they're not invited to the annual meeting. So all of the material, from the hardness of this floor to the softness of your chair to the elements that make up the lights are all just different combinations of atoms, a basic building block. So one of the things about atoms is they can exist in a couple different, there's some imbalances here. So we'll look at hydrogen here. And this is what we call an isotope. These are all hydrogen atoms because they have the same number of protons, but the number of neutrons vary a little bit there. So you've got hydrogen, which has one proton, one electron. You've got deuterium, proton, neutron, electron. Tritium, proton, two neutrons, electrons. So what this does is just means that they're unstable. They don't just exist normally. So they're constantly, these higher ones are emitting energy. It's called radiation. It's emitting radiation. Now this process happens randomly. We can't know exactly when it's going to emit off this radiation, but we know that if we watch it for a long enough period of time, how much radiation it's going to emit. And as it's emitting this radiation, it's giving off energy, it's actually becoming a different material. It's becoming a different material. And the process is called radioactive decay. It's spontaneous, it's random. However, over time, we can be very reliable with a statistical pattern. So the way that we date things is because we know how long it takes these things to degrade, we can come up with timescales. They're called half-lives. We can know how things decompose. And I've written just a series of different half-lives here. The half-life of an isotope is defined as the time it takes for half of the parent isotope to decay into the daughter element. So if you have uranium-238, it's an unstable isotope. It's constantly giving off energy. And after 4.5 billion years, it's going to turn to lead, Pb, lead, 206. It takes 4.5 billion years. Uranium-235, another isotope of uranium, it's going to eventually degrade down into another isotope of lead, 704 million years. Thorium to lead, rubidium to strontium, krypton to argon, carbon to nitrogen, all give us different time scales, and this allows us to build up just how we can date things. So what you would do is if you found, say you found a rock, you want to know how old the rock was. You take it and you put it in a mass spectrometer, which is a really cool little device, and it hits it with ions and it sends off all the elements. You can count how many of each element is in there out of a sample. So you know how much uranium is in there, and you know how much lead is in there. Now you have to make some assumptions there. First, you have to assume that there was no lead in that initially when it was formed, so that all the lead that you're finding in that is decomposed uranium. So it's moving from uranium to lead. If you know the ratio of those two things, then you can come up with how long or how old that rock is. And you do that with the age equation. Now, I wasn't going to throw a lot of equations in here, but imagine if you went to like an art gallery. You'd expect to see some pictures, right? Well, you're at a scientific top, so you're going to see some equations, all right? The age equation. So you've got 1 over the decay constant. That's what you come up with all those half-lives. And you take the natural log of the number of the number of atoms of the daughter product divided by the number of atoms of the parent product. You put these in with the decay constant, it'll give you how old a material is. It tells you how long it's been around. And we're very, these are all very accurate half-lives. We've calculated them multiple different ways, experimented with them. We know that those are right. Now, the thing is you have to use the right ones at the right time. Like carbon dating. The half-life is 5,717 years. So we say that we can go through about 9 to 10 iterations of it, keep on cutting in half before it doesn't have enough material there for us to say with any accuracy how old it is. So carbon dating is only good for something up to about 50,000 years old, at the max. So when you're hearing about dating methods and you say, hey, we found this fossil and it's 3.5 million years old, what did they come up with? What was the method they came up with? If they say carbon dating, no. You can't take carbon dating that far. Usually what they'll do is they'll date the rocks around it. So they found a fossil, they have rocks around it, so they'll date those rocks, assuming that those rocks contain the fossil. There's a lot of ifs in this dating method. It doesn't mean that it's incorrect, but it requires some interpretation. There's some assumptions here, and I think I wrote those in your notes there. The first one, in order to date a rock, you have to assume it hasn't been tampered with. You're assuming that if you're doing, let's say you're doing krypton-argon dating, you have to assume that this material started off with no argon inside it, that all the argon that's in there is there because it decayed from krypton. So that's kind of a big assumption because no one was around when that rock was formed. So you gotta make, that's one of the assumptions that are made. The second one is there's lots of things that change this ratio, things like elemental formation, solidification. So if it was in a molten state and then it formed together, that's going to reset that time clock. Heating, remelting, shock, mixed with other minerals, high energy radiation, and here's the big one, exposure to water. If something's exposed to water, it's going to change the chemical makeup out of it. It's going to leach out different minerals. So what are one of these events that we know took place in the beginning? The flood. The Bible is very clear about there being a big old gigantic flood. So how can we date these things accurately? It just means this. It means that you have to be careful when you're interpreting stuff. You can't just take it for granted. If we know that water affects all these things, then we know that there could be some error in this. So we've got this flood that's happening here. We also said one of the big things that changes it is heating. If something's heated or melted. I have a couple examples here of some really bad dating. In 1901 in Hualalei, Hawaii. I know I said that when Lynn's probably like, what? That wasn't even close. They dated the volcano there. It erupted in 1901. So people watched it. You know, they know it's in the historical record. 1901 exploded. They did krypton-argon ages of the rock material. Guess what it came back at? 1.1 billion years old. 1.1 billion years old for a volcano that erupted in 1901. It's because of the melting process. We know that it melted. We saw it melt, so we don't take that date seriously. But how much stuff do we date that we weren't there to observe the first time? There's a lot of stuff, vast majority of stuff. In 1912, in Katmai, Alaska, another volcano, they used krypton-argon ages. This one was 4 million years old, is what it dated at, 4 million years old. So that's also to show you there, if this one happened in 1901, 1912, so within about 10 years of each other, one dated as 1.1 billion years old, one dated as 4 million years old, both way off, but both way off from each other. So it's not like a consistent, you know, factor you can just figure out, okay, you know, if it's a volcano, you subtract this much. It's totally dependent on all the minerals taking place, what was present when it solidified, what, you know, how much gas was coming up from the depths of the volcano. All these different things can change those dates. So you want to be very careful when they date something. Say, okay, was this melted sometime in the past? Was it infiltrated by water? You know, what happened here? What happened with it? So there's a lot of interpretation required when it comes to radiometric dating. A lot of interpretation required. The other thing that you hear going on the use to date things. How many of you guys have been up to the Grand Canyon? All right. If you haven't been to the Grand Canyon, you live in Arizona. Seriously, gotta go to the Grand Canyon. Millions and millions of years to form that canyon, based on erosion data. So what they'll say is, and I say they like it's some person out there that wrote these rules, scientific community comes up with, they know how things erode. They say, okay, this is the erosion rate in this kind of material as water passes. With this you know, this water flow, this material, this is how long it would take that canyon to form. So it's not just coming out of nowhere. You know, they've got some evidence behind it. However, we see lots of examples of this process happening much quicker because we don't know exactly, you know, the time span of what happened in the past. If there was some catastrophic event that caused a lot more water to flow at one point, or if there was, you know, other minerals there. There's lots of factors in there. We're kind of taking a snapshot and taking that interpretation way back in time, which sometimes is true, but sometimes is not. A couple good examples of where they've done a horrible job of this. Not a horrible job, but showing some divergences. Mount St. Helens. Did anyone around here see Mount St. Helens explode? No? On TV? My parents used to live up in, my dad went to seminary up in Portland, so they saw like the ash cloud and all that stuff. So I wasn't born yet. But Mount St. Helens, May 18th is when it erupted. I think 1976, I think 1976 is when it erupted. It was just before I was born. Hopefully I'm not making anyone feel old. Within 5 days of this volcanic eruption, there were gullies and rills formed that match the size of canyons, usually assumed to take hundreds of years to form. So these canyons that under the normal erosion rates of the normal materials of what were there, that usually they would assume to take hundreds of years to form, formed within 4 to 5 days. Because it was a catastrophic event. It was something really big that happened. It was out of the normal. Within 4 years, they had 100-foot deep canyons around the Mount St. Helens. So these things that we have to look and make sure that is it really a constant law that we're taking back, or are we picking and choosing where we want to apply this? In Surtsey, a volcanic island off of Iceland, 1964, there was another volcano. Within 3 months, a whole cliff had eroded. Boulders were rounded off by the surf, and they had a nice, brand-new sandy beach, all because of this volcano but otherwise had assumed to take, you know, millions of years to form a beach and to round boulders and all these things. It can happen very quickly. And here's my favorite example. Imperial Valley, California. In 1905, between 1905 and 1907, there was massive flooding on the Colorado River. And it jumped the banks, and it flooded the Imperial Valley. Within that time frame, you know, 2 years, actually within the first 9 months, the Colorado River eroded the New River, the Alamo River, removing 450 million cubic yards of earth. That's four times the amount of earth that they removed for the Panama Canal for the 9 months. All that earth moved, and it got deposited at the very south end of what is now the Salton Sea. Has anyone been to the Salton Sea? That's a new place, 1905. That's a huge body of water to have formed in 2 years. But it was a catastrophic flooding. It was a big deal. It was something out of the ordinary happened. So we see these large things, these things that we would, having not witnessed, we would assume to have taken much longer period of time, actually can occur in a short period of time. So we just have to be careful when we're interpreting these things. Now, if you go in and you're talking with someone, the argument to have with someone is not that radiometric dating is wrong. The science behind it is not wrong. There's nothing wrong with the science. We know from quantum mechanics that this is the way that the quantum mechanics and electroweak forces, this is the way that things decay with this amount of pattern, and we know this. This part is correct. It's interpretation. We need to make sure that we're having an argument over interpretation versus the science part of it, because the science part's correct, but the interpretation part is often wrong. Just like us with scriptures, right? The scriptures are correct, but sometimes it's our interpretation that's wrong, how we apply it, how we bring out the meaning, just like so many things. So here's a couple conclusions here. There's your age equation again for those of you guys that missed it. Is radiometric dating and erosion dating wrong? No. But the results require careful interpretation. Circle the word careful there. Just careful, careful, careful interpretation. And very rarely will they, you know, when it's just, especially, I mean, you think about it too, in a news article, they've got 15 seconds to communicate a story, so they're not going into all the detail. So just know that there's a story behind the story. When they toss out a date, there's a lot that goes into forming that date, and if you're really curious about it, you can find out that information. You can find that out, or you can ask Darius. Darius can find it out for you. He's got someone can help you out there. What do these methods say about the age of the Earth? So as we date things on the Earth, using uranium, lead, krypton, argon, strontium, rubidium dating, all these give an age of the Earth of 4.55 billion years, plus or minus 1%. So they're very consistent, all these things, showing that the Earth appears to be very, very old. And this takes into account, you know, lots of different things, lots of different rocks all over the world. So what do we do with that? Is it all interpreted wrong? Does the flood at this point, you know, we have a consistent point in time where this could all get reset. So does that factor into it? Possibly. So we can either draw two conclusions. Either the Earth is old or is it created with age. Either the Earth is really, really old. The Earth is 4.55 billion years old. Or God created it with age. We know that he created, in the creation account, that he created with age. He didn't plant little tiny baby trees when Adam went into the garden. They were full mature trees. He didn't create Adam as an infant. He created Adam as a man. He created the animals fully mature. All these things, he created them with appearance of age. To what extent, though, did God go to that? As our president, like, that's outside of my pay scale to answer that question. At what point did God create things with appearance of age? If all the scientific evidence is pointing to 4.55 billion years, then did God make everything look that old, all of the Earth and all that stuff? Does that point to the gap theory, where at the beginning God created the heavens and the Earth, and the Earth was formless and void, and darkness fell upon the deeps, and then God created light? There's a gap there, so maybe he did create it 4.55 billion years ago and then started the creation process at a later time. That fits in with that. There's lots of things that, if it is old, it shouldn't mess up our faith. It's still compatible with Scripture. It's still okay to think it. Could he have done it with the appearance of age? Absolutely. We see it with a lot of examples. Did he have to for us to remain constant in our faith? No. It's not an either-or question. It could be, you know, how do we apply that? So the Earth is old or is created with age. Here's one of the things that throws... The reason why I don't think the flood is that big of a factor, the flood can affect a lot of the stuff and a lot of the things that we see in archaeology and things like that. When it comes to the age of the Earth, the problem with that is that we got some moon rocks. And the moon rocks are 4.55 billion years old too. And the flood didn't hit there. So to say it was all just a flood it's not being intellectually honest. You're heading down a wrong path. And that's one of the things that if you're arguing with someone with a scientific background, they would throw that one at you, and you'd be like, "Oh, well, that's where that curveball come from?" So I just want to let you know that's out there. The moon rocks are that old too. So either it was old, or God created with age. Either one, still does not affect my view of the salvation story. Still totally consistent with what Scripture says, and can do there. So that is radiometric dating. Next one, this is the hot button one. We're going to talk about the modern genetics / evolution. I love this quote here, and I didn't put who did it first. We'll play a game here real quick. Quote from the International Press Conference announcing the completion of the Human Genome Project. So this is sequencing the human gene, the DNA, all the genes that make that up. So coming up with like a complete list of what's on there. This is a quote at the International Press Conference. "Without a doubt, this is the most important, most wondrous map ever produced by mankind. Today, we are learning the language in which God created life. We are gaining ever more awe from the complexity, the beauty, and the wonder of God's most divine and sacred gift." Who do you think had this quote? Toss out some names. I bet you're not going to guess. Einstein? No. Not Einstein. George? No. Bill Clinton. I love that. That's great. Bill Clinton. See, he wasn't always wrong. So, coding the human genome. Let me explain like how hard this was. Human genome is 3 billion letters long. The human genome is made up of four coded letters that make up each gene. It's got 3 billion of them all together long. If you were to read this out loud, saying like three letters per second, it would take you 31 years to read it aloud, going nonstop from day and night. 31 years to read the human genome. If you were to print it out on 12-point font on paper, the book would be taller than the Washington Monument. That's the complexity that goes into each one of our DNA strands that spells out everything about all the attributes that we have, from our hair color to whether you have asthma to your ability to run really far or your eye, all of these things. Everything that makes up who you are is transferred in that DNA sequence. That's the way that God chose to store information. God designed that. He didn't have to go through all that complexity. He could have done it a million different ways. He chose to do it in this way. So let's look at just a little bit about what the DNA is. DNA is the molecule of life. And here we've got just kind of a picture of what a DNA strand looks like. Here are those base pairs that I was talking about. Those are all the letters that make up the genes. And then Sean took like 3 hours to set that up, and I just made it crooked. So, sorry, Sean. If you were to stretch out your DNA, it's 2 meters long. In each cell, you have trillions of cells, 46 human chromosomes, 3 billion DNA. Approximately 3,000 gene codes for proteins that perform most of life's functions. This is all the intricacy that's in every single cell in our body. So what does that mean? Well, here's one thing. Let's just explain what the theory of evolution says. Theory of evolution says that life arose on this planet spontaneously, that these genes, you know, the single-cell organisms emerged out of kind of a primordial soup, that there was enough energy there was enough chemicals that it, you know, randomly assimilated. And once it got randomly assimilated, then the process that we now understand is very clear, the process of natural selection took over and produced all life that we now have. Now, here's the things that are correct about that. The correct part is the natural selection part. That genes mutate over time. That genes, when every time a person, you have a child, your DNA and your wife's DNA are replicated in that child. And every time you do that, every time a cell is reproduced, there are about 60 errors in that change of coding. Out of those 3 billion, 3 billion letters, there's about 60 errors typically. Now, most of the time, these 60 errors are on places that don't produce any change. They fall into a place where, it's part that you just would never even know. It doesn't affect your day-to-day life. That error is replicated, but it doesn't affect anything. Sometimes it falls in an area that is bad, like cystic fibrosis or some of these genetic diseases that they get passed on, sometimes from mutations, sometimes from your parents. So there are errors that are bad that we feel. There are also errors that are good. There are errors that make you stronger. Let's think about Lance Armstrong real quick. Dude's got like a giant heart. He can just suck in oxygen and produce, he can just go forever. He has that genetic makeup that allows him to be an excellent athlete. At some point in his history, there was that coding in his gene that produced that trait. And that trait was valuable. It made, everyone wants to be, well, maybe not anymore because he's kind of taking some bad turns. But for a while, everyone wanted to be Lance Armstrong, right? Yeah, man, I wish I could do that. So it's very easy for him to reproduce and to have more little Lance Armstrongs out there. So we see that natural selection process going on there. Here's a better example there. How many of you guys got the flu shot last year? Okay. How many of you guys that got the flu shot last year got the flu shot the year before? And the year before that? Dude, why you guys keep on getting the flu shot? Here, it changes. The flu vaccine changes every year because of this replicating process. Every year, if you think about all of those trillions, gazillion flu viruses out there, they're reproducing. Each time they reproduce, there's some genetic changes in it. There's some errors in coding. And that error in coding, for some of them, make it not susceptible to the antibiotics you got last year. So the antibiotics that everyone got last year kind of kills out that flu strain. You don't have to deal with that anymore. But some of them genetically modified, they mutated, and now that flu vaccine is not, it's not affected on them anymore. So then that strain blows up, and you have to get a new flu vaccine. And the same thing happens. Those are replicated. You have a new sequence that isn't susceptible to that, and it just keeps going on and on. It's the natural selection process that these mutations cause errors and things like that. You know, it goes down to something like a mosquito that carries malaria. Malaria is the big one, big problem. Malaria. How does the malaria not kill the mosquito? Well, there was a group of mosquitoes that were resistant to malaria, and they were able to carry it, and all the mosquitoes that were susceptible to malaria died off, but then they carry forth this just reproducing problem over and over again. So we see this happening all over the place. Here's the deal. It's a big, gigantic jump to say that first step, though. That first step is the problem. Once you get, and I'm not saying that this is true, but once you can get a single-celled organism with enough time, with an infinite amount of time, you can imagine how, you know, every time it's replicated, that things can change, that you can keep getting different creatures as a goal, natural selection. You can imagine that if you had infinite time. Let's just pretend that for a minute. What you can't do, how do you get that first single-celled organism? How do you get that first spark of life? There's grandeur in this view of life with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one. And that, whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Charles Darwin didn't start his theory with spontaneous life. He started with a Creator. He knew that that was a big, big jump to make, improbable jump to make. What he said was that you know, something, there was a jump that the Creator was there. Our study of modern genetics is complementary to the theory of natural selection. So when we talk about genes and everything we've discovered about DNA, stuff that wasn't even known when he was coming up with that theory, we're like, well, how does that even happen? How can one thing lead to another thing and all this gene transfer? How does that even work? Once we uncoded DNA, we say, okay, I can see how that works. So it's complementary. However, and circle that big, huge however, the evolution of life from chemicals is a significant jump to make. It's a significant jump to make. You've got the example there in your notes. I just wanted to share it with you real quick. And it's Sir Fred Doyle, or Hoyle. Okay, so he's a British astronomer, and he was a believer, and he said, okay, how would it take us to get to that initial single-celled organism? What would it take for that to spontaneously happen? So the smallest conceivable free-living form, life form needed, has at least 2,000 independent functional proteins in order to accomplish cellular metabolism and reproduction. So it needs 2,000 proteins. So starting with the hypothetical primordial soup, he calculated the probability of spontaneously generating just one of the proteins. So this is just one of the proteins, not all of the things needed for that single cell organism. It needs 2,000 proteins. He's like, what's the chance of just one of these proteins coming together? And he figured that was the chance of 1 in 10 to the 40,000th power, 1 in 10 to the 40,000 zeros behind it. Now, prior to this project, Hoyle was a believer in this spontaneous project, in spontaneous generation. But when he did this calculation, he's like, there is no way that this could just happen. There's no way that you could have this type of chance happen. The conclusion he drew is that it's about the same probability as a tornado sweeping through a junkyard, assembling a 747 from the contents. That's and it's way even larger than that. He was just trying to think of something just crazy off the hook. That this initial step, even though the science of the later part seems to be correct, that initial step is just impossible to get over. That there is a creator God. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. and he formed man out of his own image. It's hard to, it doesn't jive. Spontaneous beginning does not jive with what the Bible says. However, we can see that we don't want to throw out everything, just saying, hey, evolution's wrong. When you make that argument, you're on thin ice. It's not correct in just throwing it all out. But what parts are correct, what parts are incorrect? Where can we bring those conclusions? Interesting book that I read a couple years ago. It's called The Seven Daughters of Eve. It's by a guy named Brian Skies. And he's just a geneticist, and he's been going around Europe and the world just taking samples of people's DNA and just trying to just code it and see where everyone comes from, because you can trace family lineages through your DNA. And he determined that everyone on the planet Earth, this is not a Christian, he has no agenda, came from seven women on the scale of about 10,000 years ago. So he's able to trace everyone's DNA back to seven people 10,000 years ago. Now this is very contrary to the previous theistic or previous evolutionary thought that we all come from hundreds of thousands of people hundreds of thousands of years ago in Africa. He's saying about 10,000 years ago, we all came from about seven women. Now, as we look at our time scale, one of the other things that had to happen that we know took place after the flood, at some point here, is the Tower of Babel. What's the story of the Tower of Babel? Essentially, mankind had come together and decided that they could reach God, that they could be as great as God. And they were building a great big tower, this big huge structure. And God said, you know, man can do anything he sets his mind to at this point. So he confused man and he gave them different languages and spread them out over the world. So when science says that there's seven different strands that we come from about 10,000 years ago, this is totally in line with what we would think Tower of Babel happening in that period. If we start expanding that timeline a little bit, we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of years ago with hundreds of thousands of people. We're talking about seven people 10 years ago. We're getting down to what Scripture is saying, bringing us down to that original man, woman. Exploding, populate, exploding, coming back down with Noah, exploding a little bit again, and then getting spread out over the world. Totally in line with that. Just another one of the things where, you know, this isn't a Christian book. He doesn't have a Christian agenda. It's just straight scientists saying, hey, this is what I'm finding in DNA around the world. So that's our thing of genetics. It's complementary to the theory of natural selection. However, the evolution of life from chemicals is a significant, and I understate, that's the way too small of a word, significant jump to make. Astronomical. Actually, even bigger than astronomical, and economical. Think about in economics and how much debt we are. That's way bigger than jump to make. All right. Let's look at this last one. This last kind of scientific topic. And it is the Big Bang Theory. Big Bang Theory. And this is this very simply. 15 billion years ago, the size of the universe, which is currently 6.23 times 10 to the 27 miles. So 10 with 27 zeros behind it, miles. That's the size of our universe that we can observe through telescopes and calculations. At less than 10 to the 43rd, I'll write it here real quick. 10 to the minus 43 seconds. So that is 0.00 with 43 zeros, 1 second. And that amount of time, everything contained in the universe was smaller than the size of a proton. Like, infinitely smaller than the size of a proton. That's what the Big Bang Theory, everything was that point. And then it began expanding at that point. As it's expanding, things cool, gravitational force takes over and brings this matter into everything we see in our universe, stars, planets, all these things, based on this theory. Now, it sounds very, very anti-Genesis 1:1. But here's how the Big Bang Theory is actually one of the most positive things that has happened to our interpretive scriptures over the last couple hundred years in science. And this is the reason. Prior to this theory, it was a scientific thought was that the universe is static, that we have always existed, that the planets, stars, everything has been in their rotations, that everything is just still created this way. It's always been that way. It was so ingrained that we were in a static universe that it caused Einstein to totally flub up on his first round of the general theory of relativity. He's developed the general theory of relativity, just this monumental work. He's throwing everything out. He's like, everything. He took all of Newton's work and just said, no, none of that's right. Nothing's right. I'm starting from scratch. And this theory predicted that the universe was expanding. He's like, well, the universe is not expanding. It's static. Everyone knows it's static. So he threw in this fudge factor to show that the universe was not expanding, that it's always been constant. However, within a few years, the Hubble Space Telescope was working in California, and he began observing, looking out. Everywhere he looked into space, he's noticed that things are expanding, that are heading out. So what does that mean if everything's moving out? Well, if you reverse the arrow of time, that means at one point everything was together, that it had a beginning, that there was a beginning to the universe. This was radical, that the universe actually had a beginning. Before that, the scientific thought, you know, Einstein, it threw him off, everyone. Universe is standard, stay put. The universe had a beginning. And that was just a theory at this point, saying that everything spread out. So they began, like scientists do, making some predictions. Well, if everything was at one point and expanded from there, we should see certain things in the world around us. We should see an afterglow, a constant temperature throughout the universe of that initial Big Bang. That we should see, within that Big Bang, we should see ripples in the fabric of material out there. All these things that they thought they'd never get answered. But they're like, if this theory is correct, then these are the things that we should see. Well, in 1964, these two technicians, Penzias and Wilson, they're technicians for Bell Labs, and they're making this microwave antenna. And they're trying to tune this antenna, and they keep getting this static on it. And I think it's kind of funny. At first, they think it's pigeons up there. So they go up there, and they kill all the pigeons on the roof. And they thought that was a problem, but they're still getting this static. And they begin tuning into this static, and they find out that it's a radiation source from out in the universe. And it's at 2.7 degrees Kelvin. And they publish this. They're just like, hey, we're finding this. And this exactly matches up with the prediction they made years before, that if the Big Bang theory was right, then we'll have a cosmic background radiation of 2.7 degrees Kelvin. These things start fitting together, that yes, there was a beginning to the universe, that there was a single moment in time where everything started. The Big Bang theory was beginning to support what had been thought was totally incorrect. Prior to the Big Bang theory, the creation of the universe, the common scientific thought was that we lived in a static universe. Thought was that we lived in a static universe, but where we find that actually it's not that way at all. The wheel of universe that started at a single point in time, that there was a beginning to it, and then it expanded from there. Here's some positives from it. Positives: Big Bang theory requires a point of time for creation. In the beginning, God created. There was a beginning. Creation came from nothing. I put parentheses nothing because it's not really nothing, because we can't calculate all the way back to time equals zero. In fact, as we study the laws of physics, we'll explain this, the time really isn't relative to what we're talking about. Time is something that shifts around a little bit. There are other constants that we keep track of. Time isn't the deal. But when we go back to as far back time as we can calculate, we get that mass of everything that's ever existed smaller than the size of a proton. That's pretty much creation from nothing. And it sets out, the third thing is, it sets out a process of forming and then filling. So it's forming the universe around us. Gravity's pulling these clumps together. That it's bringing stars together. It's bringing planets together through the laws of gravity. And then once those are formed, then they fill with everything we see today. And this is really the reason why I point this out, is these are the things we brought out of Genesis chapter 1. What were the big things there that God created? In the beginning, God created. God started it. He created everything from nothing, and then he created with a process. Those are the things we could pull out from those scriptures. Here's the negative. The negatives is the time scale. It's 15 billion years old. So we go back to that question. Is it really old, or did God create it with age? And that's really something that you kind of need to settle yourself. It could be either way. It doesn't affect the salvation story here, whether God created with age or whether it's actually really old. How do you reconcile that? All right, it's 11:06. We've got one more session here. So let's take just a quick 5-minute break. If you need to use the restroom, if you had too much water with your cookies or whatever. And then we're going to come back and we're going to wrap it up with my favorite part of it. We're going to talk about how big God is and how intricately designed he's made the universe. So you guys are dismissed. 5 minutes, we'll come back and wrap up.